Blog Talk Radio.
Experience with co-host Dolly Miller Brennan.
Produced by CommunicationCreations.com.
And now your host, the notorious MJH.
Tonight is our cast percentage show. Yes, Cass is back after the holidays. Hey, Cass, how was your holidays, sir?
All right, Mike, how about yours?
Oh, great, great. Can't complain at all. They went by so quick, though. You know what I mean?
They did. Actually, I really enjoyed the time off. Actually, I spent time with family and everything. And then on New Year's Eve, we decided to try our karaoke skills with the Xbox 360 Rock Band.
Did you record an MP3 that we can play for the audience?
No. Actually, my wife had taped me singing some Beatles music, and I said, nah, I hope you're not going to put this anywhere we go public.
Okay, I'll have to email her on the sly and get an MP3 of that for the show.
Yeah, it was really great, though. I had the kids come in from college, and we just sat around and, you know, just played till midnight and then brought in the New Year in, and Christmas was great, and had my grandson come in from Austin and so forth. And so it's been really great. I hope yours was really good. And did you do anything special?
Oh, yeah. I didn't really do much, but, yeah, it was it was cool. I just, like, laid back and relaxed and, you know, you know, like, I hide sometimes. Like, kids can't find me, so. So tonight, Cass, you are going to speak about waste and abuse conducted by the federal government, federal and state governments, and the utility of direction in corresponding. Wait a minute. I can't read Dolly's writing. Dolly is not here yet to do this herself.
Yeah,
she's become the last minute. We're going to call her last second Dolly from now on. Okay, she'll come in like 5 minutes after the show starts. Why don't you tell us what you're talking about tonight, sir?
Well, Mike, what we wanted to kind of do from now on, from this point forward, is just kind of start looking exactly what the issues are that the American people really focus on with the upcoming elections in 2012. Now, it's very common, you know, for public and media and so forth, and as well as political parties, pretty much set the agenda and say, okay, these are the things we need to focus on. And you know, you have media outlets saying, okay, it's the economy, we need to start to be unemployment, or it's, you know, abortion, or it's national defense, or it's health care. And they're all major issues, which I'm not going to downplay. But, you know, once everything's said and done, the question is, it's kind of like what happened after this current election is, okay, now what are people going to do that they pretty much went ahead and decided how they wanted to vote? Which brings me to the topic about saying, all right, now let's look at how you implement these programs that you do pass, and how are they going to be either cost-efficient or somewhat qualitative to meet the people's needs. And that's where, you know, federal governments come into play and state governments come into play, and more or less the agencies they create in order to implement some of these programs they install and so forth. So that's basically what we're going to look at, is specifically, you know, what I'm hearing from the people saying, you know, we elected you for less government, we elected you for fiscal responsibility, we elected you to do these things, now we want you to kind of do it. Matter of fact, I just wrote an article, I don't know if you read it or not, it's called Truth or Dare, the Political Process, and it got posted on the Texas GOP website.
Awesome. No, I've not read that, but I will make a point to
it. It really focused a lot on the Texas House Speaker race that was going on. And I summed up the article pretty much saying, you know, as kids, you know, you took a truth or dare question when you were younger. Either you want a truth or dare. Do you want me to tell me the truth or do you want to take a dare? And I looked at our last election pretty much going along the same line in reference to metaphorically saying the candidates were going out there saying, here's what we're going to do. Here's what we're promising you. Here's what the people said they want to hear. So that was the truth part. Then comes the dare part. Says, okay, now we're going to dare you to do it. And what we're seeing is we're not sure if they're going to follow through with their promise. So it kind of goes back to that same old concept where, you know, is this business as usual or is this really going to be a new direction for the American people? And that's actually what I want the campaign to really focus on, is that, you know, as a United States senatorial candidate, especially for the state of Texas, is, and also working for a nonprofit agency that works for the state, I'm seeing a lot of, you know, bureaucratic BS that's coming down the pike that's not really helping out the people who are requesting and are paying for these services that they requested. And then I'll go into that a little more specifically with details. But that's pretty much the direction we want to say is, you know, we want the people to realize that, or not even the people, the politicians to realize that, you know, it's time for you to ante up and stick to your guns and realize that there's a lot of waste, a lot of abuse that's going on in our bureaucratic agencies that we need to kind of cut them down. We need to really seriously cut their authoritative legislative authority to make laws that or policies that that really hurting the public and hurting our economy and hurting the entrepreneur who's trying to make things happen. Does that make sense?
I think that's one thing that affects a lot of politicians is the bureaucracy, and it just hinders their goals. You know, they can come into office going, yeah, well, you know, these are the goals, this is what we're going to set forth, this is what we're going to work towards, but then there's all these hindrances coming in, you know, due to bureaucracy that really isn't their fault. But to be able to stay focused on that, with the 2010 election, and I actually watched on TV. I would love to have seen it in person, but I actually watched on TV Nancy Pelosi hand over a gavel to John. I can never pronounce his name right. Is it
Bomer?
He spells it weird.
Yeah.
Bonner. I guess you just pronounce it like B-O-N-N-E-R, don't you?
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess you do. So just John Bonner, because I always try to pronounce it the way it's spelled, but it never comes out right. So you know John Bonner, and then you know he's like, okay, from now on, you know he's saying we're going to listen to the people, and that. You know, he might be saying that, and it might be harder for him to do as Speaker of the House than he really intends. You might find that out. I think the first session of the new Congress was yesterday, I think. So, you know, he might find it a little harder, but at least he's got that mentality where he's going to listen to what the people have to say. Whereas with Nancy Pelosi and Obama, it's like you never really feel like they're listening to the people, and that was just so frustrating.
It's going to be a little difficult, but there's one of the things, you know, speakers of the houses, whether it's at the federal level or at the state level, you know, they have a lot of pull and power because in a lot of ways they get to decide what's going to go before, you know, legislation and what's not going to go before the floor. You know,
right.
So if you have something or some congressman who wants to put in a flat tax, for instance, okay, he writes it up. Well, depending on how it gets logged in, and then when it gets logged in, then it goes, of course, to committee, and then goes to subcommittee, and then if it goes there, eventually it makes its way to, you know, to the point where it even makes it to the floor, even gets to put on the calendar. All that, you know, is pretty much kind of controlled by the Speaker of the House. So if you're really not going to, you don't want something to go through, you're not going to put it on the calendar for any time soon, and then you're going to let it die in committee. And I think from that perspective, it's easy to say he has control over that to some great degree, except for the committees. But even then, you influence the committees with, you know, some political clout. On the flip side of that, then you look at, okay, let's just say it already goes through the whole process. The Congress votes on it, gets passed off to the Senate. They vote on it, approve it, send it to the president. He signs it into law. Okay, now you have an act or a law in place. then all of a sudden you have to create a bureaucracy or an oversight agency to make sure it happens. And they initially probably start off with Fidelity from a Fidelity perspective with the good idea of putting it into place. But then once it's kind of like human nature. You give somebody power, then they're going to go ahead and run with it. And let me give you an example. You know, in the state of Texas, we're looking at a $27 billion deficit. And I work for a nonprofit agency who also follows a subcontracted out to the Texas Department of State Health Services, which also specifically provide, you know, some substance abuse treatment. Now, we went ahead and put in a grant, a request for proposal, for a supported residential program. Now, what a supported residential program is for those individuals who are suffering from addiction, they're able to go ahead and stay at this residential place, but during the day, you know, they still can go to work and do everything they need to do, and then they also get their hours in for treatment and so forth. Okay. Well, we got approved. They didn't prove us a lot. You know, they gave us like, I think it was $53,000 to run a supported residential program, which takes a lot more than that. So we took a little management and a little innovation and creative and said, well, I'll tell you what, we're going to take a respite house that we have, which basically is respite for those people who are in emergency situations. And we're going to take these two rooms here and we're going to make them supported residential so that we can provide the service to the community agency or to the community, and the other beds are going to still be for crisis respite. The contractors, the licensee agency, they all thought it was, you know, it's a real kind of creative because you're trying to make do with what you've got.
Right.
But because it was never in the Texas Administrative Code that we could not do it, it went all the way up to the chain, and then they said, nope, you can't do that. And matter of fact, we're going to rewrite policy that will say that you can't do that. And I'm thinking, under what authority do you have to do this? You know, because the legislature never passed anything saying you could do that. You're going off a unilateral authority that you can or cannot do this. And yet, you got these people in this county that really need this service or this treatment, but because you don't think you should mix, you know, mental health clients with substance abuse clients, you're not going to make it happen, even though they're getting their treatment in another location. So it's just some in little things like that when you have bureaucrats, and this is at the state level, and I'll go into one more specifically with the healthcare with the doctor I was talking about. But you know, it's these little things like that that kind of frustrate the people and frustrate even county commissioners and county judges who are saying, look, we have these issues in our county, and you up there in Austin or you up there in Washington are kind of like doing your own thing. And we understand that, you know, you're part-timers in Austin because you're not in session every time, but you have these bureaucrats up here who don't even communicate with each other, from the contracting agency to the financial agency to the inspection agency to the licensing agent to the performance agency. You have all these agencies that don't communicate with each other. So then when we send up a response, they come back and say, well, we didn't know about that. Well, don't y'all just talk to each other? Don't you just go down the hall and say, hey, look, this is what we got on this person? You know, it's really interesting. Well, it's not interesting. It's basically Washington at the lower levels. And
it's
just
frustrating is what it sounds
it
like.
Is. And I was meeting with a county judge in one of the counties the other night. He was telling me the same thing. He goes, I have a problem. You know, I need these people to get, you know, evaluated. Or I need this person to be, you know, in this place, but I can't do that, and I can't violate their rights because, you know, they're not a danger to themselves or others. And then you say, well, why don't we get APS, which is Adult Protective Services, why don't we let them come in and you know, make the call because, you know, that's their job. And they come in and say, well, no, it's not really kind of fall within our jurisdiction. And if somebody wants to do that, they can go ahead and do that. And we can't keep them from doing whatever they want to do.
Well, I mean, it sounds like my job. I mean, you know, I can call the operations manager, and he'll tell me one thing, and then the bookkeeper call me back, whose office is right next door, and ask me the same thing, and I'll say, well, the operations manager just told me, oh, well, I didn't know he told you that, so, you know, I wouldn't even call you. And their offices are right next to each other. So, you know, I think the one guy talked to the other guy before he called me, but no, they didn't talk to each other. And I can just only imagine how that is on a scale where, you know, the people's offices aren't right next to each other. They're either down the hall or across the state or across the country.
Mm-hmm.
And Yeah, so there you go. That's one thing slowing things down. And then what you mentioned is, you know, a deficit. Your state deficit, I think you said 26.
Project about $27 billion for the next 2 years.
Okay. And then the national deficit is $14 trillion right now, which is almost what our whole economy adds up to. So, I mean, that's dangerous. And, you know, so, you know, if you look at all that, you're going to look at, okay, well, what can we cut back?
Exactly.
And, right. And then, you know, if you stay up at late at night once in a while, you'll see these commercials on TV, infomercials, they call them, and they sell these books that tells you about all these monies you can get from the government for grants and stuff like that and nobody knows about. Mm-hmm. And they actually tell you on these infomercials that, you know, there's billions of dollars, you know, put away for these funds that nobody is using. And, you know, if you buy this book, we'll tell you how to do it. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, is that true? I mean, are there these programs that are not being used?
Well,
because if there are, and I'm not blaming anybody, I'm not pointing a finger at anybody. Maybe somebody set up these funds one day and they just weren't used. So can't we go look for those and go, well, if nobody's using them, let's put this money back into circulation?
We see, that makes too much common sense, Mike, if there is. And bureaucracies don't run on the common sense. You know, there's a traditional view that they run by the letter of the law, and then they make the law, and they say, well, we're still running by the letter of the law. Now, in reference to, is there funds out there? I mean, it's always been that we see often where the Internal Revenue Service says, we have so much people who have not collected their income tax returns, and you have this amount of time period to do this to collect it, or you're going to lose it, and stuff like that. So there's strategies sometimes by these agencies that they use to kind of save money for the end of the fiscal year. You know, when I was in the service and then I was a cost center manager, one of the things we had to do is propose our budget for the next fiscal year. And then after we got it, you know, we had to spend it. But when it was getting close to the end of the fiscal year, usually about 4 months out, they're saying, hey, we want to know what you're going to spend your money on and give us an outlay of what it is, because if you don't have an outlay, we're going to take the money back. So,
right, because if you didn't spend it, you don't need it.
Exactly. You don't need it, you don't get it.
Right, so you can't save it for the next year going, no, you know, this year's going pretty good, but we might need it for next year. So you can't put it away. You got to use it that year.
So there we go on a spending spree, spending everything like crazy, just trying to make sure we end up having it for the next fiscal year. And it's no different from the state, but I think they do it a little differently because they do it actually at the end of the second quarter. And the beginning of third quarter, say, okay, are you going to spend this money? Do you need to amend your contract so that we can transfer money for this, for that, so that you can go ahead and get reimbursed, or we can spend it where it needs to be? But an example would be of how they can manipulate a situation is, for instance, there's one facility this fiscal year that it got awarded $2.5 million to provide substance abuse treatment, residential and outpatient, all together for one county. It's in one county, even though it's supposed to be serving the whole region. But a majority of that money went to, because it's a grant, it is going to pregnant females who use IV drugs. Well, there's not a lot of pregnant females who are using IV drugs, at least in this part of the neck of the woods.
I'm glad there's not.
There's a lot of youth, and there's a lot of adults, you know, that use drugs, period, that need treatment that we can't get into because there's no funding for them. But if you put $1.5 million away to these programs over here, and then all of a sudden you're coming around the end of the year and you haven't used it, guess what the state's going to do?
They're going to take it back. Therefore, they see that you didn't actually need it.
Exactly. And they know you're not going to probably use it all, but they know that you're not going to use it, so let me put it there, and then I can tell everybody that I'm trying to treat a population that's very high risk, and they are very high risk. But the question is, are there really quantitative numbers to substantiate that kind of funding for it? You know?
Right, but neither can you take that money and put it someplace else where it will be used, even though it's under the same department, because it's not what it was put there for. I forget the word for it.
Well,
delegated.
Yes and no. Yes, I mean, they got to bring it back, and they got to use it within the Department of State Health Services. Now, the Department of State Health Services is a big entity. There's a lot of programs under the Department of State Health Services. So they can easily pull it back and take it out of the mental health or the substance abuse and then transfer it over to, you know, public health or to prevention or to diabetes management or to FEMA.
Well,
or
they can, but you can't.
Oh, you can't?
No. I mean, they can. They can transfer the money. But I'm saying you're running your department, and you go, well, we got a surplus of $500,000 over there,
mm-hmm.
and we have a deficit of $500,000 over there. Could you transfer the $500,000 from one department that you run to another
locally?
Department?
Locally, no.
Locally. That's what I mean.
Yeah. I have to go to the contract manager who says, all right, we need to get permission to make sure this can happen, and there's a need there, and they would end up authorizing, and they'd talk to the financial people who would end up moving the money, who's going to end up having to answer to, you know, maybe the Texas Council saying, okay, why are we transferring money? Let's don't transfer that much or whatever it may be. You know, that's just the bureaucracy of it that we kind of look at and saying there's a lot of waste that's going on. What I would like to see happen, actually, to be honest with you, you know, did you hear about the governor of California and what he did with the cell phones?
What did he do with cell phones?
Mm-hmm.
No, I didn't hear about that.
He told all his state employees to turn in their state cell phones. That was 48,000 cell phones. And it's projected to save him a little over $200 million plus a year.
Wow. A lot of money.
That is a lot of money. But yet, and that's a good example where, you know, because they're getting this federal money or you get money from the, you know, property taxes or you get money from sales tax or business taxes, whoever it is at the state or the federal level, you know, they're supposed to fund these programs, and somebody cries, well, we need this or we need that, and they go ahead and fund it, and all of a sudden you have a deficit, and you say, oh, so what are we going to cut? Well, you know, you have to cut some stuff like that, but you and I know what the number one cost for any business is, right?
The number one cost?
Mm-hmm.
I think it depends on the business, but I don't know. What is it?
Personnel.
Oh, okay. Yeah, salaries. Okay.
Yeah, once you pay salary and benefits, you know, you're going to be paying out, you know, big bucks, you know, especially with the Obama health care, if it doesn't get repealed, is that you're going to be paying big bucks out for these employees.
Speaking of Obama health care, I am so glad. This is one thing that John Bonner's doing that I really
mm-hmm.
like. He's putting all the bills out on the Internet before they vote on them. So people actually can read. Because if they put that health care bill out there, I don't think everybody would have read it because that's really long. But enough people have read it and gone,
mm-hmm.
wait a minute, that's just not for, you know, providing health care for the elderly or people who can't afford it. You know, they're trying to control us.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you should have heard Dolly and Larry and James Rife, the Reverend James Rife on here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they were a couple of weeks ago when they were talking about that. They were talking about the I think they called it death committees or something like that.
The death panels.
Death panels. That's it. And you know, there is something in that bill where, you know, they're trying to bring back where, you know, death counseling and stuff like that, whether somebody wants to, you know, stay on to the machines or just let it go. You know,
mm-hmm.
it's up to them, and they would want to offer this counseling. But yeah, this could easily like spin off into where the government's going to control when you're born and when you die. You know, because when I say when you're born, they're also doing this stuff with I don't know, stem cell research and stuff
mm-hmm.
like that. So you know, they're actually, you know, controlling when people are born. You know, when babies are born and what sex they're going to be, and
mm-hmm.
then they're going to control when they're dying. I'm sitting here going, you know how quiet I can be. You know when there's a conversation going on and I'm not involved, I'm just listening and learning and stuff like
mm-hmm.
that. And I'm sitting here going, damn. Have you ever seen the movie Logan's Run?
It's been a while.
That's what it reminded me of. And then Larry's on here talking about, yeah, the government could go bankrupt at any minute, and you know, we won't have any fuel, and nobody can get to work, and make sure you get 3 months worth of groceries and water and store it somewhere. And I'm going, wow. I mean, just talking about this stuff, it sounds like the apocalypse is coming tomorrow or something, the way these people are talking. And I'm sitting there listening, going, well, you know what? I mean, I could go, that sounds like, that's not going to happen. That's not going to happen this year. That, but what if they're right?
Well, and I think a lot of it's really driven by the fact that, in my opinion, and probably in many others' opinion, and probably even the politicians I know one have said that, is that the and what I mean politicians, both congressmen as well as senators and at state or federal level, is that they're not in charge. The bureaucracy is in charge. They're the ones that enforce the laws that they pass, and they're the ones that dictate the policy. So I remember I was at one of my congressman's town hall meetings, and he specifically made that comment. That's one of the reasons he did not support term limits, was because he goes, these bureaucrats are the ones in charge, and we have to establish this relationship with these bureaucrats. And
who are the bureaucrats, though? Because people say they say the bureaucrats. Who are the bureaucrats?
Well, I would classify the bureaucrats, especially being a student of public management, and a member of the American Association of Public Administrators.
but if you can finger somebody and say it's the bureaucrats, who are we pointing to? Are we pointing to the lobbyists? Are we pointing
to the
politicians? Who's ultimately in charge? Ultimately in control. And then
the bureaucrats actually are all in any federal, or let me phrase this, any federal agency, commission, or board, either at the federal level or at the state level, because they're the ones that kind of pretty much write the law specifically. And I think, for instance, if there is a law passed that nobody can wear white hats, okay, Congress passes that law. Well, how are we going to apply that specifically to in writing to each state each state agency understands that? And who's going to monitor and make sure that happens? Who's going to enforce that? And that's where the agencies kind of come into play, because they're supposed to be subject matter experts in those areas about wearing hats, how they're going to make that happen. To give you an example would be like if anything has to do with environment, will fall under the Environmental Protection Agency, but can also fall under another agency as well. And they would end up making policy decisions on something that happens.
Excuse me, sir. Are you on your cordless phone?
Yes.
Big channel.
It's channel. Hold on.
Okay. So the bureaucrats are the agencies that are nominated or appointed, I guess is the word. The you sound much clearer, sir.
Yeah. Is that better?
Yeah, absolutely. I thought you hung up there. It sounded like you hung up because it was like completely silent, but I realized I didn't hear a click. Yeah, that's much better. So bureaucracies are the agencies that are appointed by federal...
Yeah, exactly. They're appointed by the president to, the EPA guy or the Homeland Security. Well, those are the big ones. But then you have other agencies below them. Whether this is a bureau... Center for Disease and Control and Prevention, and then you got below them you may have the National Institute of Health, and below them you may end up having Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Association, and then below them you may have another one. But you have this tiery, this hierarchy of all these bureaucracies who kind of have an impact on how legislation is enacted, and they are very influential. They do control how things are done in the United States. So, it could be the FDIC or the Federal Reserve Board. That's an agency in itself.
But we actually need those guys because nobody's an authority on everything, so we appoint committees to look into things and, become the authority on it and figure out what's best and report to the president, basically.
Well, and that's where, we go to one would have to study specifically what was the role, and I'm going to use this loosely, of public administrators. Okay. Mm-hmm. And public administrators are those individuals who pretty much work for, you know, the public's interest on ensuring that the funds as well as the services are provided in accordance with, you know, the laws that are enacted. The issue is, though, is that depending on, and this is where I'm kind of looking at it from this perspective, depending on the training and education that these public administrators had, depending on what graduate school they went to, will define what kind of authority they should or should not have. And that's what's pretty much has been trained in the last 20, 30 years, has been public administrators have been trained to say, well, if Congress can't decide what to do, then we will make it happen. And they're no longer looking out for the interest of the people. They're looking out for the interest of what they think needs to happen.
Right.
Now, the big shift is, of course, going back to saying, well, hold on. You really have to think of, for instance, a city manager. A city manager who's running a city will think of his as the citizens as either customers, or will he think of them as citizens? And the train of thought is that they're trained as customers. Now, a customer is somebody who receives a service. Okay, they're someone that gets something in return. A citizen, on the other hand, is somebody who participates in the process.
Okay.
So which makes them equal, not somebody saying, okay, gimme, 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 I'm the customer. No, a citizen saying, no, what do we need to do to make this happen? Where they hold the city manager and the city council or whatever, maybe what form of municipality they use, they hold them accountable to ensure they're supporting the citizens' needs, not the customers, because citizens are not customers, they're citizens. And that's a new paradigm, kind of what they call the new public administration model, where it's saying we need to start having more community involvement. We need to have more citizens involved in the process versus just empowering, you know, certain individuals or certain boards or certain agencies to make decisions unilateral.
Right. Well, I'll agree with that absolutely, because people don't speak up as much as they should. They don't write their congressmen and their senators and, you know, on paper. They might email them or sign a petition here and there or just get on Facebook and bitch, but they don't actually sit down and write a letter and send it to their congressman and go, look, this is how I feel about this bill you're talking about. I might not completely understand it, but I don't think the health care bill, there's some points that are great about it, but there's some points where we're too much. Too many of our freedoms are being jeopardized because of this bill. So I don't think you should pass it right now. I think you should wait and, you know, just whatever they feel.
Yeah, I totally agree, because I do believe, you know, it goes back to when I'm looking from the healthcare perspective. I do strongly believe we need some healthcare legislation. I just don't think we need, you know, the healthcare legislation that the Obama administration passed. You know,
I don't either, because there's too much in that bill that doesn't pertain to health care.
Yeah, like my financial student aid that I got to pay for my graduate school. And actually, I was calculating that the other day. I said, okay, now according to this, now that the federal government owns all federal student loans, and no longer goes to the banks or anybody else, I have to pay Uncle Sam. And I said, okay, after 10 years of making this payment, I am doubling what I borrowed. It's like a bank.
Have you heard about this? Here in Virginia, they're about to make a state bank.
Mm-hmm.
Have you ever heard of that? It actually sounds socialistic as all get out, but it actually makes sense because we still have private banks here. I mean, they're not talking about doing away with that, but it actually makes sense. But because the state needs money for this, that, the other thing, actually technically the Commonwealth,
mm-hmm.
but because they need money for this, that, the other thing, they're talking about loaning people money and making interest on it and using the interest to pay for the stuff they need.
Hmm.
So if that goes through, we'll actually have state banks here in Virginia. So you can go apply to them just like you would Bank of America or any other. I'm saying Bank of America because I know they're nationwide, but your local bank, your local federal credit union or whatever it is, you know, you can go to the state or the Commonwealth Bank of Virginia and apply to take out a loan and loan you the money. It just works like any other bank. And I'm pretty sure you could actually open up savings accounts and stuff there too.
Well, it definitely sounds like the government's into the banking business, just like the federal government.
Well, you see, if they're trying to take over banking, that I have a problem with. If they open up state banks or even federal banks, because I really don't think that's a bad idea, but it's when the government tries to overstep its boundaries and actually control the industry of banking or control the any industry,
mm-hmm.
Even healthcare.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's when I start to go, okay, that's going too far because we don't have a choice. Or maybe we still have a choice right now, but 10 years from now, 20 years from now, 50 years from now, we might not have a choice. The government will be in control of everything. And that's the part that scares me. You know, like what Larry and them were talking about if the government goes bankrupt and there's a fuel crisis. And,
mm-hmm.
and I don't understand how we can have a fuel crisis when we have surplus fuel here. We just don't, we call it a reserve and we don't use it. You know, I don't understand that kind of stuff.
Well, that's intended to be used, I guess, in times of national security, so to speak. In other words, its primary purpose would be I know that when Bush tapped into it was to help offset, you know, some of the gas prices and the supply and demand during, you know, the first part of his administration. And that's actually when gas prices were really low, kind of, to be honest with you.
Right, but I'm saying if Larry Bauer's theory, you know, ever comes to truth,
mm-hmm.
and the there is a fuel shortage, national fuel crisis, and,
mm-hmm.
and the government files bankruptcy again, and we could actually give Larry a call right now because he could fill you in on mm-hmm. all this stuff. I mean, I'm just going by what he said. I'm summarizing,
mm-hmm.
But you know. But what he was saying is that in 1933, the government filed bankruptcy, and they actually, basically mortgaged everybody's houses.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not even sure. It made sense when he was explaining it, but I don't know how to explain it the way he did. But they basically, you know, like they got the government out of debt by pulling everybody's property and gold. You know, that was another big thing. Everybody had to forfeit their gold.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, at that point, you know, they wrote a bill, or they wrote something. I asked them exactly what it was. I should have wrote it down. But they wrote this thing that said this isn't a republic anymore. It's a communist state now. Do you want me to call him? I can get him on here and he can explain it to you.
No, that's okay, because actually I've been reading some of that, to be honest with you. And it's kind of like I was reading the other day, the Sturgill's Act or something like that. It's right around that time period when they went ahead because you had a competition between commercial banking and investment banking. And the Supreme Court kind of ruled on one of these things saying, you know, you can't compete against each other. But then they ended up making, at that point, investment banking, authorizing their paper money to be considered as... what's the word I'm looking for? Well, basically making it equal to money. And at that point, investments making got into commercial banking and started taking over the commercial bank industry and mortgages and stuff along those lines, which, you know, we started getting away from, you know, the dollar a lot and the value and having the dollar being supported by gold to paper money, which is what we're using a lot now with Wall Street and trading here and there, because there's really no money being traded in Wall Street. It's all this commercial paper.
Mm-hmm.
But it's being treated by the federal government as, and I forgot what the word is, and I should look it up again, but basically they're saying it's basically money.
I know what you mean, because like when you look at a dollar bill, it says this is a note.
Mm-hmm.
So... I mean, you know, it's not like the dollar bill itself is worth anything that you're holding. It represents $1.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it like replaced the barter system. You know, it's a 12 mm-hmm. chicken tiers a dollar.
And that's where it says where I was talking about was with investment banking is you didn't have you know, i.e. cash, dollar bills, notes, they actually had just commercial paper, like a piece of paper says, okay, this is worth $100 million. Okay, mm-hmm. Based upon the fact that, you know, it is now. and that's what was being traded and being used to buy, you know, securities within the commercial banking industry. And then you had these antitrust laws kind of come into play and stuff along those lines. But, no, I hear what you're saying in reference to, you know, a lot of things. Actually, and this goes right back to the 1930s, which right around the Great Depression is when a lot of changes happened with the United States in reference to, you know, going from a republic to more of a democracy, to more of a, you know, other area, so to speak, to where, you know, you had Social Security, you had more, and this is where public administration, believe it or not, started having a different view and broke away, because this is something I didn't know before. I didn't know, when I say public administrators, but was really part of the political science process at one time. Public administrators were really political science majors. And then they broke off because of, you know, what was happening on during the Depression, and they wanted to go their own way, and then they went from management away from business management and so forth. But a lot of things were happening during the Great Depression, and then people took governments took very crisis actions and started taking over a lot of property, to be honest with you, to try to come out of the Depression. And that's one of the fears I think I see now, is that we have a tendency to use a crisis as a reason to go ahead and give the government the right to go ahead and do whatever they think they need to do, whether it's in the name of national security or whether it's in the name of an emergency situation or whatever it may be.
Yeah, and that's another thing that's been talked about in the recent weeks or so, is the position of Obama's in, where he can declare a presidential, I forgot the word for it, but you know, you pretty much declare martial law if he has to, and you totally
mm-hmm.
bypass Congress.
Mm-hmm.
And back to the fuel crisis, hypothetical fuel crisis, but if it happens, we have the reserve. So how would trucks stop running? You know, because if it actually crippled America to where nobody could get to work, to where trucks couldn't deliver groceries to Walmart or whatever the case may be, wouldn't we pull that fuel reserve out and use it then?
Honestly. No.
No, really? We just let America be crippled, you know, transportation-wise?
Well, here's the thing with the fuel reserve. It would only, from what I last heard, it would only last about 3 months anyway.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but that's exactly how long Larry Ballard said that if this happened, it would last, was 3 months.
Well, and the thing is, though, they use that fuel, first and foremost, is going to be used for two things, and I'm not in part of that disaster management group up in D.C. who makes out these plans, or Department of Homeland Security who makes up these plans. But the first thing it would be used for would be for the military.
Right.
We have to have the fuels to run the ships, the jets, the tanks, and, you know, the submarines, okay? Because we've got to be able to defend ourselves, because if we don't, then somebody can come in. And the second thing it would probably be used for would end up, because it's going to go in a rationing system is what it would end up doing. And the second thing going to be used for is going to probably be used for those, what we call, what was it? I remember he used to say it all the time, essential, the emergency essential agencies. Okay? So that can mean, you know, police departments. That can mean fire trucks, ambulances. It could probably mean use it for generators in hospitals. Okay? And then, if need be, we can ration maybe some of that out to private industry, because you're talking about Walmart, which is a private industry, even though it's providing service for the whole nation, like moving food.
I just use that as supermarkets, just any place you buy groceries from, necessities, you know, food, water, you know, the basic necessities. I did say Walmart, but just basically.
Well, yeah, no, I know what you mean, but I was thinking more of the food portion of Walmart versus, you know, the electronics department.
Right.
You know, so, but, and then they would end up getting their rations of being able to do that, which wouldn't be surprising, you know, if you wouldn't see the National Guard actually doing that, you know, and just putting it in the back of their big, I forgot what they're called, big trucks anyway, and just loading and transporting just what's needed in certain areas for that, because they know that the fuel's not going to last very long, and God forbid, then all of a sudden, let's just say some country decides to go ahead and invade. Well, guess what happens? That we start eliminating those rations from the others and start putting it at the very top, which would be defense. So no more for the fire trucks and no more for the policemen or the ambulances. It's all going to go back to defense because they're going to use more now to defend the nation.
And at this point, according to what Larry and, you know, what we're talking about now, at this point, money, you could have $100,000 worth of cash in your hand. It wouldn't mean anything at that point.
No.
That is so scary.
It's just paper, is what it would be, because, and I think we talked about this one time, because we run our economy on a fiat system versus going to a commodities kind of system, like gold, like tobacco at one time. Was a commodity that was used as cash. It was a cash crop.
Wow.
You're able to buy stuff back in the beginning of our country was, you know, you could go pay with tobacco, not have to pay with cash. So, and that's just the way, and it goes back to some of those things back before our time, you know, that's what it was kind of set up as well. You know, a lot of trading was done that way, you know.
Well, that was basically the barter system, you know. I mean, maybe not chickens and hens, but... Mm-hmm. And, yeah, Larry did mention the tobacco... what do you just call it? The
cash crop?
Cash crop, yeah. Mm-hmm. Like it was actually used for cash. That's why they call it that. I didn't know that until, like, last week. And you were mentioning it, too. It's really weird how you and Larry Ballard and Reverend James Rafe are all talking about the same things. And I don't think you guys listen to each other's shows.
I'm sure you're
together. And it's just really uncanny how you guys are basically saying the same thing.
Well,
so what do we do about this, Cass?
Well, and I think it's just a good thing is that we do have elected a Congress that's willing to, like you said, John Bomber. Who is willing to go ahead and start
it?
There you go. Who's willing to go ahead and make this happen? For me, I kind of see it as a senator. I would end up saying, okay, one, we need to get our fiscal house in order, and that's actually what the American people want, and that's what you know, hopefully our new Congress is going to do, and that is saying we're going to have to start cutting government. Yes, we do need some of these agencies. I'm not going to say we don't because, you know, if you let big business go wild, they get greedy and they'll end up, you know, reason why we started unions in the first place to some great degree.
True. I agree with all that.
But at the same time, though, we don't need, you know, seven different people working in one for one agency in one department when you can really cut it down to three or four. I mean... You know, this is one of the things that the military has done and is doing now is, you know, one person used to come in and he was maybe a payroll clerk, okay? And they trained him or her to be a payroll clerk. And that's how they probably would do the majority of their career. And they say, you know what? Because we don't have as many personnel anymore, we're going to have to train you not just to be a payroll clerk. We're going to have to train you to be our finance clerk. We're going to have to train you to be our supply. We're going to have to train you to do all these other things. Not just one thing. Oh, and by the way, we're also going to train you, which you've already been trained, but we're going to have you also go out and be on the front line, like infantry too.
Mm.
So they started saying, okay, everybody's got to be universal.
Well, in the military, once somebody has a rate or a that's what you call it in the Navy, but a mode of what do you call it? MOD, isn't that what you call it? A mode of
method of operation? Or
no, what you're trained to do when you're in the military?
Oh, in the Army it's called MOS.
MOS, that's it. Yeah, in the Army,
yeah.
They call it a rate. In the Army, well, it's actually in all branches of the military, but they don't call it that in the Navy. So your MOS, mm-hmm. Once they actually train you in something, well, it costs a lot of money to send you to school and training,
exactly.
And all that stuff. And at that point, you're not on the front line anymore. So, you know, because like it costs too much to train somebody.
Oh,
why back in Vietnam they. You could be a chief and be a pilot if it was a helicopter because you only had a 10% life expectancy rate.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, so they didn't train you to be an officer. You know, just fly a helicopter because they knew you were going to die as soon as you got out there, basically. Or those were the probabilities.
Well, and that's the way it was in the old days, but nowadays it's totally different. I mean, you have MOSs, you have AFSCs, you have these career fields that have to start merging and saying, well, you know, we're going to have to consolidate some of these because we don't have the same kind of funding or the same kind of manpower we once had, and we have to kind of make people universal. And this is actually, if I step out on the private sector, so to speak, our American workforce is no longer a skilled workforce, which basically means no longer are they really trained to do one skill. Now they're becoming more of a knowledge workforce, which basically means they're getting the skill and the knowledge, not just to perform one task, but multiple tasks. So
well,
makes,
you have to.
Exactly.
You have to keep a job nowadays. You have to learn how to do burgers and fries and run the drive-thru.
Exactly. But
I mean, really, I know what you're saying. I'm just joking around. But even on that scale, yeah, I mean, because, yeah, if you're just standing there loafing, pushing a mop, and, you know, and they got to cut somebody, hey, guess who it's going to be? You know, if you can run the whole show and you're doing it for, you know, minimum wage or just above, you know, whatever you're doing it for, you know, they're going to keep you. And you might need that minimum wage if things come to what they're coming to or might be coming to or whatever.
And here's the even though we see that and, you know, and even businesses kind of seeing that, the agencies don't see that. They continue to segregate and separate. Say, oh, no, that's not my job. You got to go to contracting. Oh, no, you got to go to quality management. Oh, no, you got to go to, you know, finance. Oh, why don't you go talk to the director of clinical care or whatever. You know, they keep on breaking it out to where they protect their job. And that's,
yeah, I've noticed that, and I hate to say it because, I mean, jobs, you know, like people are losing their jobs anyway, and corporations are downsizing and all this. But, yeah, I mean, if you look at it, I mean, there are a lot of positions in business that could be cut, you know, like the position itself, maybe not necessarily the person, but that position where, you know that particular person who was doing that job could be utilized in different areas. So I completely understand what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
Like human resources. Okay, you know, maybe you need a couple of people in there for the big corporation, but, you know, is it a full-time job for 12 people when, you know, like it's just a department store and you got one guy in HR, yeah, he does the hiring and, you know, if there's any complaints or something like that, he takes care of it. And if there's unions, we've got to deal with the shop steward. But do you really need 12 people in there to deal with every little different gripe? You know, just people, go do your job. If you're glad you got one, go do it. Thank you.
And that's where it goes back to us in looking at fraud, waste, and abuse, so to speak. You know, and there's a lot of fraud, waste, and abuse in a lot of our agencies that really we need to probably start cutting back on. And there's probably some programs we need to really cut that really aren't, you know, cost efficient. And I hate to bring that up, especially on a program issue, because you know I'm not a candidate or saying, you know, how effective was this program based upon how much it cost. I'd rather look at the outside and say, well, how effective was it in meeting the needs of the community or the meeting the needs of the citizen?
That's what you should look at.
Well, unfortunately, under the new under the Clinton administration, we shifted all our federal agencies to go more into what we call the model where you start measuring everything on a cost analysis or cost benefit basis. You know, how much is it for the electricity, for the roof, the water, and everything, for the payroll, and how does that come out to, and how many patients do you see? And then, you know, they started using these formulas to dictate, you know, whether it was cost efficient to do an x-ray or not. You know, but if a guy's got a broken leg and you say, well, God, you know, the doctor wants an x-ray, give him an x-ray. But, oh, well, hold on, I don't know, you only are authorized 4 or 5 x-rays for the month, and do you really want to use it on this one patient? So everything is really, you know, cost efficient now, and it's gotten away from qualitative service, which you can't measure quality, to be honest with you, other than through, you know, through feedback satisfaction from either the customer or, in this case, the citizen. You know, you can go to the Federal Drug Administration, go ahead and change it and make K2. Are you familiar with K2?
I'm not familiar with K2.
Synthetic marijuana.
Oh, they don't have that here.
The FDA can go and say, we're going to start making this a Schedule 1 drug because it's...
Oh, are you talking about Spice?
Or Spice, yeah, that's another name for it.
Oh, I know what you're talking about now. Yeah, they banned that here, or they're trying to or something. I know the military is not allowed to buy it anymore.
Yeah. But
I know,
like,
you're talking about now.
Exactly. So the FDA goes in there and says, "Okay, we're gonna outlaw this, we're gonna outlaw that, and we're gonna make this illegal, make that illegal." Well, you know, those are good ideas, but are they gonna really be effective? Because they're just gonna change the chemical makeup of it with something else, and then you're gonna have to outlaw that. And then change it again, and you outlaw that. I mean,
look, criminals and hackers, they're always going to find, no matter what kind of law you make, no matter how hard you try to enforce it, no matter how harsh you make the penalties, they're always going to find a way around it.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that's just the criminal mind there.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that's going to be an ongoing battle. There's no solution to that problem. There really isn't.
But we'll go before a subcommittee or a committee, or the FDA go before a committee and say, since we outlawed this, we've noticed 50% decrease in K2 overuses. Well, yes, probably true, but they came out with something else called, you know, logwood or something, I don't know, and that's gone up 50%. So, you know, that's why I'm not crazy about quantitative measures to try to measure or to dictate programs, you know.
I think right now we just need to focus on getting our... we always need to focus on the fundamentals, the fundamentals and stuff like that, of course.
Yeah.
But right now we just need to focus on getting our economy stabilized.
Exactly. And I think... I've read a lot about when you're talking about... what was his name? Dr. or Reverend Wright?
Reverend Wright, yeah.
Yeah. And I've read a lot of stuff, actually, from a lot of you know, different sources, and I can see some of the writing on the wall, but I guess at the same time, though, I do have maybe call it faith that I think we can do this without having to go down that direction. And it starts off with initially limiting the control of the bureaucracies and getting our fiscal house in order.
Right. Yeah, it's just, you know, I really, you know, like when we started the series here on Blog Talk Radio, the Cast for Senate show, Liberty Crusade show with Larry Ballard, Cultural Theology with James Rife,
mm-hmm.
You know, when we started this, I didn't really intend to get down the path of conspiratorial theories and, you know, the world is going to end and and all this. And, you know, I keep thinking back to every generation. I've heard this before, that every generation since the Bible was written has thought that this was going to be the end of the world. And, you know, maybe now it kind of looks like it if you read the book of Revelations and some of the things it says in there, and, you know, the road we're going down right now with stem cell research and you know, just like, mm-hmm. you know, all this stuff that, you know, we are stepping on God's toes in some places, you got to mm-hmm. admit. But I mean, when, you know, when we're talking about it, like, you know, actually, you know, within the next year, you know, I mean, all gas, you know, people can't get to work because there's no gas, there's no fuel, you know, the dollar won't be worth anything. And, you know, I'm sitting here, I look outside, you know, I look at the TV, I'm like, I just can't picture that happening. But could it?
Well, yes and no. Yes, it's very possible to happen. And no, I don't think it can happen if we do something about it. I mean, I think, you know, if it is the end of the world, and this is, I was talking to a coworker, I said, you know, I'm fear for my, if it is the apocalypse, if it is the end of the world, you know, I feel for my family more than I feel for myself. And then my coworker said, why should you fear if, you know, you're okay? Because actually it should be a good thing. Because if you've been doing good, then you're going to go to heaven. I said, well, that makes sense. So I'm not too worried about that now. But what I'm worried more about is, what can I do now to prevent that, or to improve not only our legislation processes, but the quality of life for every American, especially those in the state of Texas.
Right, and I kind of look at it like this. If it's not going to happen, great, but it's something we should think about, and it should scare the hell out of us, and it should scare us straight into doing something about it, you know? I mean, you, sir, I respect you so much for running for senator, and, you know, everybody who's taking part, you know, whether they're running for Senate, or whether they're running for any kind of political office, or whether they're just volunteering, or
exactly,
whether they're... you know, just whatever they can do. If they just walk outside of their door and see a piece of paper on the ground and pick it up and throw it in the trash, they did something. And, you know, that I can respect. And, you know, it's the people who just sit there and gripe and criticize that, you know, I'm sorry, I just don't have time for them, you know?
And, Mike, you nailed it on the head, because that's really what it really all comes down to. And that's one of the biggest things I'm pushing with the campaign, is about getting active. You know, if this is going to come to an end, okay. But you know what? That doesn't mean I'm going to lay down in color. I'm going to try to fight for whatever thing I can. So that means that every individual, from picking up a piece of paper to going and voting to, you know, donating to writing the congressman, you know, making every effort to be active in the process, versus, you know, say, oh, well, we're doomed, the sky's falling, let's just go ahead and let it happen. You know?
Yeah, because instead of just calling the people, calling the city and going, hey, there's trash outside of my door, just in the same amount of effort, go pick it up and throw it away.
Mm-hmm. If you see somebody who needs some help, hey, go help them, you know.
Absolutely. Whatever you can do, just whatever you can do, do it. I mean, that's always my philosophy, and I'm not trying to sound like a Nike commercial, just do it. You know, I've had that philosophy long before, well, I don't know if it was long before Nike came along, but it was long before they came out with that commercial. If you can do something, do it.
Exactly. And I'm glad you say that, because I actually use that even in my therapy sessions, you know, and I'm saying, you know, either you want to or not. All you have to do is, first thing is put your first foot forward, and you've already started. Just do something.
Amen, sir. Hey, I really appreciate you coming back and talking with us. And your website is CasForSenate.com. That's CASFORSENAT for Senate, correct?
Yeah. Yes.
See, I didn't forget. I even remember how to pronounce your name correctly.
Yes.
Mr. Castanuela.
You did that really good with the N.
It was so hard for me to pronounce your name when I first met you. I was like, Dolly, you introduce him. I can't say his name.
Well, I appreciate you, Mike,
really
bringing it back. And the good thing is, Senator Hutchinson said today that she is not going to run for re-election. So we're going to have a new senator from the state of Texas.
And that's going to be you, I hope. I feel
it's an uphill battle. I mean, there's a lot of individuals who would prefer me not to be there, and they'll use whatever political clout and channel they can. But either way, I'm going to make a firestorm one way or another.
There you go, sir. Hey, it's up to the voters. Don't listen to those naysayers.
Yeah.
Just get your name out there. Let people get to know you.
Yep, and that's the key. All right, Mike. Well, let me let you be because I think we probably hit time, huh?
Yeah, we're a little bit over, but no big deal. Okay, everybody, this has been Andrew Castanuela. And, sir, will you be back next week with another topic?
Yes.
Okay, great.
Yes.
All right, great. And we'll be back next Thursday night at 7 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Central, if you live in the great state of Texas. And this is hopefully your next senator we've been talking to over there in Texas, Andrew Castanuela. Thanks, everybody. This is MJH. Peace, God bless, and we're out of here. Later.
Take care, Mike.
You have been listening to the MJH Experience on Blog Talk Radio.
Produced by CommunicationCreations.com.
Do you know where you're going?